You're Connected is the official audio podcast of the Miami University Alumni Association, available exclusively to the organization's dues-paying members.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you. I'll ask first, can you hear me in the far reaches of the room? Any problem at all? I can't see over here. All right. Very good. We're gathered on the 27th day of October, 1982. A few days before Halloween, and I expect there's no coincidental relationship between these two events. It's about this time of the year that people always begin to ask about mysteries, ghost stories, etc. There are some that relate to this university. There are some good ones. There are some that relate only as legend, not as fact, and I won't get into those. I suspect that years from now, there will be others added to the list as they become evident. I propose tonight to talk to you about several of the very well-established, well-authenticated, yet mysterious happenings in the past of this university and this community, as they relate to specific individuals. The one probably best remembered, the one called Ronald Tamman. Another, well-remembered, she today more heralded perhaps than she's been in the past because we now have an uptown restaurant that likes to talk about Lottie Moon in an underground sense as a person of real mystery. Let's take each of these in turn, beginning with Ronald Tamman. It was a snowy night in April, 1953. Late April, as a matter of fact, too late for a snowfall, and yet it happened. Sunday evening, the 19th of April. The snow had been falling, the ground on the campus had turned white. The trees just beginning to come out in spring bud were etched in whiteness on the tall spruces and pines in front of old Fisher Hall. There was a capping of white on each one. When they returned from the city of Dayton, where he had gone for a weekend, the roommate of Ronald Tamman, Charles Finley by name, returning about the midnight hour as April 19th was giving way to the 20th. He came in the front door of Fisher, up the stairs, to the second floor, down the hall, to that far northwest corner room, room 225 Fisher, to find the door open, the lights on, the radio playing, a textbook opened, obviously. It had been used not long before. Its owner had been studying from it. No matter whether it was physics or psychology, probably the latter, it was a text. Beside it, a wallet, a watch, car keys to a certain 1949 Chevrolet for which the owner had a legal permit to have it on campus. And on that desktop, a two-day-old receipt for the payment of a one-year insurance policy on that Chevrolet. Everything there to indicate that Ronald Tamman, from whose pockets all this had come, whose possessions all these were, had apparently left the room, certainly expecting to return. Charles Finley waited an hour, and when his roommate did not return, he concluded he would turn in himself, go to sleep, confident that Ron is probably somewhere else in the hall, or at the most he might have gone off to a fraternity house, but that he would be back before the evening was over. Charles Finley went to sleep, slept all night long, woke up the next morning to find the light still on, The radio still playing, the text still open, the watch, the wallet, the car keys, the paid-up insurance policy, all still there where they'd been the night before, but no sign of his roommate. Ronald Tamman had never done this before. He was an exemplary young man, not very tall, but very well coordinated, quite muscular. He was, in fact, a varsity wrestler in one of the lighter weight classifications. He was a scholar, a Dean's List student. He was so well regarded on campus that he'd been selected to be a resident advisor of Old Fisher Hall in the corridor in which he lived. He was an accomplished musician. The reason he had that Chevrolet, the permit for it, was that he played bass fiddle in an outstanding campus dance band called the Campus Owls, known across Miami and all across the state of Ohio as one of the finest collegiate dance bands around. And he used that Chevrolet to haul members of the band with himself to engagements they might have outside Oxford virtually every weekend. Ronald Tamman was an exemplary young man. No reason for him to have gotten in any difficulty. And yet here he was on Monday morning, April the 20th, still not in his room. For some unaccountable reason, he had vanished. Charles Finley alerted the authorities of the hall. The dean of men's office was informed. There was still an expectation that any hour would find young Tamman returning to his room. It simply didn't happen. That night, it was decided that if he still didn't come in the next morning, a search had better be made of the valley area near Fisher Hall. The next day, the fraternity in which Ron Tamman held membership participated in the search out a distance of a mile around Fisher without finding any trace. No sign of any foul play, no one lying there in the ground, head possibly injured by a fall. No sign of Ron Tamman. The ROTC was then invoked. Would 400 cadets extend the search 5 miles out from campus? Indeed, 400 Air Force ROTC cadets volunteered their service and they went to it, up and down the valley, as far out as Houston Woods. They even examined the cistern behind Fisher Hall to see if possibly Ron Tamman's body might be found in it, all without finding a trace of him. The Butler County Sheriff was then called, then the Highway Patrol, soon the FBI. An all-points bulletin was sent out, indicating the disappearance from the Miami campus of a sophomore from Maple Heights, Ohio, 20 years old, about 5 feet 8 inches in height, by the name of Ronald Tamman. With this description, there came a phone call from a woman in 7 Mile, Ohio, not many miles down the road from Oxford, between Oxford and the city of Hamilton. She said that on the night in question, about midnight, she had been aroused by the knock on her front door from the hand of a young man. And when she answered the door, she found standing there, bareheaded, without a coat, a young man answering the description of Mr. Tamman. He asked her how he might find his way to a bus stop. Now, there's no bus stop in 7 Mile, Ohio. The nearest bus stop is in Hamilton, a number of miles down the road. She thought it strange. His hair was tousled. He had a bewildered expression on his face. It was cold, it was raw, and he had no coat. She told him that the nearest bus stop was in Hamilton. Down the road, he should continue several miles until he'd find it. He thanked her politely, turned and walked off the porch and disappeared into the darkness. She thought it strange that she didn't hear the sound of a motor. No car drove off into the dark. And now, the All Points Bulletin had attracted her attention to the disappearance of a Miami sophomore, and she thought she'd better inform the police of what her experience had been. The sheriff of Butler County called it the best lead they'd had. He said it might indicate the possibility of an attack of amnesia. And the young Tamman, a victim of amnesia, might be wandering the landscape without knowing who he was or where he was going or why he was going. That was April 1953. The weeks passed by. That summer, an assistant dean of men on this campus, Hiram H. Stevenson and his wife Kay, were traveling across New York State, had gotten into Upper New York, and they stopped at a roadside inn for lunch one day. They sat down at a booth. I. Stevenson, as he was eating his lunch, let his eyes wander around the room, and as they did, they encountered the face of a young man sitting alone in a booth on the far side of the room. I. Stevenson thought to himself, "My heavens, that looks like Ron Tamman." He turned to his wife, Kay. "Do you know, I just had the strangest experience. I was looking across the room, and I thought I saw Ron Tamman sitting right over in there in that booth." And he pointed, and the booth was empty. He got up, crossed the room. There was no sign of the young man who had occupied it. He went out in the parking lot. There was no sign of anyone leaving the building. The young man had disappeared. A second lead, possibly. A big question mark on it. We'll never know. That fall, school resumed. Ronald Tamman's younger brother, Richard, returned to campus for his sophomore year from Mabel Heights. As perturbed as the rest of the family and the rest of the campus about the continued disappearance of his older brother. It was in late October, about this time, that for the first time voices began to be heard in the formal gardens just beyond Fisher Hall. About midnight, singing in a high falsetto voice was heard. Those in the hall thought it strange. They never heard anything quite like this. The second night, again about midnight, that strange sound coming from the gardens. It was at that point that some in Fisher thought if it happened again, they would be out there in the gardens to find who it was who was singing in this fashion. The next night, a group of them were out there. When the singing commenced, they had the impression of a figure all in white. They moved towards it. It was at that moment that the figure apparently saw them and began to run. It ran so fast that those pursuing it couldn't catch up with it. They said it was running at almost superhuman speed. It disappeared in the direction of the golf course. We don't have the golf course today. We have Millett Hall standing on it instead. But that was the direction this white-clad figure had taken. Then in November, singing again from the direction of the gardens. This time a voice that would range the octaves from deep bass to high falsetto and back again. First night, no one paid it heed. The second night, when it returned, a group of RAs from Fisher Hall decided to go out there and investigate. As they approached the gardens, they discerned, this time, a black-clad figure, long-haired, long-legged. And as they approached, the figure began to run from them, again in the direction of the golf course. They pursued it, but only half-heartedly. The next night, again the singing. This time, a group of freshmen from the hall decided that they would be more bold than the RAs had been. They would set off. 25 of them. Bravery in numbers. As the one who was in the lead, and they got the closest to this black-clad figure, explained it later, the closer I got, the less interested I was in catching him. This time the figure dashed towards the ravine, down the hill towards the Talawanda. The freshman broke off the pursuit. Out of all of this would come the legend of a ghost at Fisher Hall, a phantom of old Fisher. Several years elapsed. The ghost didn't return. The phantom was no more. When up in Dark County, near Greenville, the operator of a sand and gravel pit found one day in the course of his digging the skeleton of a young male estimated to have been about 20 years at the time of death. It had the approximate build of a Ronald Tam. The gravel operator, knowing of the Tam disappearance, called in the authorities. The authorities, in turn, called in Dr. Raymond C. Bobby, state archaeologist from Columbus, who promptly pronounced it a well-preserved glacial cane Indian, dead about 3,000 years. Certainly not Ronald Tam of Maple Heights, Ohio. The years continued to pass by. In 1960, Ronald's mother passed away up in Maple Heights. His father would remarry. Eventually, he and his new wife would leave the Ohio area and go down to Florida in retirement. The other members of the family would scatter. But still, the interest would remain in the fate of Ronald Tanner. It was in the middle 60s, with no new leads, no new clues coming in, that it was suggested by persons unknown that a medium ought to be involved, who might attempt to bridge the gap between this world and the next, and invoke the spirit of Ronald Tamman to come back. The effort was made in Old Fisher Hall itself. 200 primarily students met together as we're doing tonight in the old dining hall of a dormitory now condemned by the state architect as unfit for further habitation, no longer safe on its second and third floors, the upper floors barricaded, barbed wired to keep all intruders out. But the dining hall was on the first floor at one end. It could be used as the university theater, and it was, through the middle and late 60s until a new CPA would come into existence in this section of campus. They met that Halloween week, as a matter of fact, Halloween night in the 60s, as the medium sought to invoke the spirit of Ronald Tam, with no success. The next day, a speech class out there in the same dining hall, as it was listening to a lecture, heard muffled sounds in the floor above and wondered what it might mean. Later, another Halloween season, another medium brought into the picture. This time, one who reported a vision of a young man coming down the stairs alone at night from a second floor room down into the basement of Old Fisher by himself, opening a door, finding in the room in which he walked two men engaged in doing something that was wrong. The medium couldn't tell what it was. these two, surprised by the entry of this young man into their midst, whether they were burglarizing the place, whatever, the medium couldn't tell them. But surprised by this young man, they turned on him. There was a struggle. Blows were struck. The young man fell to the ground, dead. And then the vision was that of the two dragging the body away, up out of the basement, down a deserted corridor, out into the darkness, to a hillside, digging a hole, putting the body in, closing it over. Where that hole might have been, the medium couldn't tell. The stories with the passage of time would mount. Coming now primarily from members of the Dramatics Division of the Speech Department, with offices out in Old Fisher Hall. Stories coming out of experiences usually at night, and they'd be working at their desk, of lights mysteriously growing dim and then coming back up again. On a couple of occasions of chandeliers moving back and forth ever so slowly. Of footsteps on the stairways. In the corridors above, the stairways, the corridors that were barricaded, barbed wired, but footsteps nonetheless. One story in particular recounted how one dramatics professor alone in Fisher at night, at about the midnight hour, was out there in the old hall when a severe electrical storm hit. The lightning was flashing, the thunder was rolling, and it was at that point that he heard footsteps in the room directly over his head. He decided that was the time, whether or no, to get out. He got out as fast as he could. It was about that point that we began to find evidences of paper torches in the old building, suggesting that in the period in which the building no longer had electricity, there were those who were entering it in spite of the fact it was barricaded, and to find their way from room to room, from corridor to corridor, they were literally wadding up newspapers and lighting them to carry them as torches down the peeling, deserted hallways. It began to dawn on us that if this continued, sooner or later there would be a tragedy. Just one of these had to be dropped in a corner filled with debris, and the whole place could go up as a raging inferno. It was a wooden building with a brick skin. And then the decision was made not to delay in the demolition of the building. The effort had been made over a long period of time to avert its demolition, to save it some way. Fisher Hall came down in the summer of 1978. As the workmen were working on its demolition, they were asked, as they took down partition by partition, floor by floor, to keep a lookout for a skeleton of a young man. Would Ronald Tannen be found at long last, as the building was demolished, his remains somewhere in those partitions? They kept that lookout. They found no evidence of a skeleton. But as the walls came down one by one, they revealed, interestingly, a whole glossary of Greek letters, fraternity slogans. It had been evident over a long period of time that fraternities at the university had been using the old building. evidently sending pledges out to go on in to what was fast emerging on campus as a haunted hall, sending them up to one of those corridors late at night without electric lights. Yes, to go back to room 225, the room of Ronald Tenney, and then to come on back to the fraternity house and report. I suspect those were footsteps that the professors heard in the floors directly overhead. The footsteps of young freshmen, just as scared as the professors down below, just as eager to get out of that place as fast as they could. And apparently on some of those assignments, they were ordered to leave the fraternity signs back there in those walls. And as the walls came down, there they were, dozens of them on every floor. Old Fisher doesn't stand anymore. Beautiful new building has taken its place, the Martin Cotton Center, right on its side. But from the old building, some 5,000 bricks were saved to be incorporated in and around the new Conference Center, that there could be a bridging from the past to the present, that somehow some of the mystery, some of the mystique of the old could continue into the new. The ghosts of Fisher Hall, they're behind us. The new building, I suspect, won't have any of these, but it will have its share of memories of some very real Miami mysteries. Now, there's another building in town that hasn't been inhabited now for about a dozen years. At the corner of University and High Street, we know it in Oxford by the name of the Lottie Moon House, one of the oldest houses in this area. When my family and I came to Oxford, we found ourselves living two doors down the street from it at Lewis Place. Our address was 310 East High. The Lottie Moon House was 220 East High. It's a pastel shaded building across the street from where Red Skelton is now having his temporary Miami residence in Simpson House. They're facing the old campus. The Lottie Moon House, one of Oxford's oldest, goes back to the early 1830s when it was built. A two-story brick structure with a handsome iron fence around it on two sides. It was there in the year 1839 that the Robert S. Moon family moved, having come to Oxford from Virginia by way of Tennessee. The Moon family moved into Oxford originally to live at the site of the present Beta Theta Pi National Headquarters. They were there several years and then moved down the street a couple of houses into that residence, 220 East High. The Moons were from the South. They made no bones of their Southern proclivities, their Southern interests. But they adapted well and easily to the Oxford environment. They made a lot of good friends. As the years passed, five Moon children grew up in that house. Two boys, three girls. The oldest of the girls, a young woman named Charlotte, nicknamed Lottie. She was not, by any standard, a beautiful girl, but she was vivacious, petite, quick-witted, charming, attractive in her own way. She had a lot of boyfriends. As a matter of fact, she had a lot of serious proposals of marriage by the age of 18. Like so many, with interest from many, there becomes one out there from whom there's no interest being shown, on his part, that becomes then the most interesting one to the young woman. The one out there who would pay Lottie no heed, no attention, was a southern man, also from Virginia, by the name of Jim Clark. He was somewhat older than Lottie, in his middle 20s when she was still a teenager. In today's vernacular, he wouldn't give her the time of day, wouldn't pay any attention to her. So there was Lottie with 12 involvements in which Joe came up owing Lottie a favor at some point. Lottie said, now is the time. I want to take that coach on into Oxford. Joe said, all right, here are the reins. Up went Lottie on top of that coach. Joe went over on Lottie's horse. And Lottie had scarcely settled into the seat. Then down came the whip across the backs of those four horses, and they took off from McGonagall for that last leg of the ride into Oxford as they had never run before. Down those same hills, up the next ones, around those curves. And as the stagecoach rattled its way towards Oxford faster and faster, the passengers inside the coach were shrieking, calling on whoever was at the reins of these horses to bring this coach under control. And the more they shrieked and hollered, the more the whip came down on the backs of those horses, faster yet. Lottie took that stagecoach on into Oxford, down the peripheral street that we now call Patterson Avenue, turned up high, down high, to the Mansion House. It no longer stands. There's a sign on it now that says lot for sale. We used to call it Jack's Corner. There was the Mansion House, a hotel that had stood since 1831, the last stop of the stagecoach from Cincinnati. Lottie pulled the stage to a halt right there in front of the Mansion House. And as they could, the passengers got out one by one. Looking up as they did, fists clenched, mouths forming as they could, the words of contempt for the one that had been in control, quote unquote, of this coach. The last one out was Jim Clark. He was all set to have his fist right there in the air until he saw the one who had guided the coach in and he knew what was up. He changed his composure immediately, turned on a sweet smile, and said, good afternoon, Lottie. Nice trip. I hoped I'd get into Oxford early today. Thank you so much. The last reaction that Lottie Moon had wanted out of Jim was congratulations. She knew now there was no way that in the next 48 hours he would ever get involved to prevent her impending wedding to Ambrose E. Burnside. And so there it was, June 1848. The church was filled, the minister was at the altar, Lottie in bride's attire and radiant in her loveliness, and there the groom in his military uniform, Ambrose Burnside. All of the preliminaries were dispensed with and they got to the subject of the occasion. The minister turning to Ambrose and asking him, do you, Ambrose, take this woman, Charlotte, to have and to hold till death you depart? And said Ambrose in good military fashion, I will. The minister turned to Lottie, do you, Charlotte, take this man, Ambrose, to be your loving husband, to have and to hold till death you depart? Lottie turned to the tall young man beside her, looked him from his feet to his head and back again, turned to the minister and said, No, sirree, Bob, I won't. And with that, she walked out of the church, leaving Ambrose Burnside jilted at the altar. Burnside had never been so embarrassed. He couldn't believe this had happened to him. Nor could the people of Oxford believe that Lottie could do this to anyone, but she had. There were those who said, never again will anyone propose to Lottie Moon. She's had a lot of beau, but not again will anyone be very serious about her after this. Well, there was someone who got serious after that. Jim Clark. And he proposed to Lottie that fall, and they set the date for January 1849, 6 months after the jilt had taken place. Now, instead of using a church, they would use the Moon House on High Street. And they determined that the bride and the groom would come down the stairway of the Moon House from the second floor to the first, where the minister would wait at the foot of the stairs to pronounce the marriage vows. There at the top of the stairs, on that cold day in January 1849, stood Jim Clark and Lottie Moon. The organ, that small portable organ that had been brought into the Moon House, was playing. They got to the wedding march. The time had come to start down the stairs. And as they were about to take the first step, Lottie felt something cold in her side. She turned and looked down to see what it was. It was a gun in the hands of Jim Clark. "Why, Jim," she said, "what is the meaning of this?" Said Jim, "Lottie, there'll either be a wedding today or a funeral tomorrow." Lottie got the message. They started down the stairs together. Every so many feet, the gun reminding her, right there in her ribs. And they approached the altar and the minister and stopped. The gun remained a firm pressure in her side. The minister began. And he, again, Daniel Tenney, the Reverend Tenney of the Presbyterian Church, again got to those key questions. "Do you, James, take Charlotte to be your lawful wife, to have and to hold from this day forward?" And said, "James, I do." The Reverend Tenney turned to Lottie. "Do you, Charlotte, take this man, James, to be your loving husband, to have and to hold from this day forward?" You could have heard a pin drop. The crowd had been through this one before. Now they wanted to see what Lottie was going to have to say. The gun reinforced what she was going to say. Said Lottie, in a voice that all could hear, "I do." A collective sigh of relief from all present as Lottie Moon became Lottie Moon Clark. January 1849. Is that the end of the story? My heavens, no. The 1840s gave way to the 50s, and in the 50s, the war clouds began to gather. The nation moved closer and closer to the precipice of a civil conflict. Here was Oxford, Ohio, 37 miles from the Ohio River, the historic boundary line between free soil and slave. Most in Oxford were free settlers, but there were some from the South whose sentiments were states' rights and sympathetic to the cause of the South. Such were the Moons, such certainly Jim Clark and his wife Lottie. Jim maintained a law practice over in the county seat of Butler County in Hamilton. There, as the 50s wore on, he became identified as one of the principal spokesmen for the Southern cause. When the war finally came, he would identify himself closely with Clement L. Vallandigham, Copperhead leader of Dayton, the arch foe of Abraham Lincoln, the principal Copperhead of the entire Union. And it would be Jim Clark here in Butler County who would be the Butler County Copperhead leader, the husband of Lottie Moon. The two Moon boys went off to service, not in uniforms of blue, in uniforms of gray. They headed south to fight for the cause of the Confederacy and secession. One of the Moon girls, Mary, attending the Oxford Female Institute, we now call it Ox College. On the day that war was declared, as the Oxford College girls assembled outside to pledge allegiance to the American flag, stood there with her hands down. She would not. No question where her sentiments were. And then there was Lottie. The Civil War was a remarkable war in that it represented first in many, many things. It was the first use of massed armies in this side of the ocean. The first use in modern warfare of automatic weapons, of ironclad warships, of submarines, of aircraft, albeit these were balloons, not motorized. It was the first war to use espionage on the grand scale, and in this, using women as the principal espionage agents. As we think back over the course of the Civil War, a number of names come out, the principal espionage agents, and those serving the South, spying on the North, included two above all others, Belle Boyd and Lottie Moon. Lottie Moon of Oxford, Ohio. The South established its capital in the city of Richmond, Virginia. And in that capital, President Jefferson Davis had a central office. Secretary of War Judah P. Benjamin had another office two doors down from the presidential office, and the office in between was that of the Signal Bureau, which was the name given by the Confederacy to its espionage service. A service that reached out across the North into a score of communities, New York and Chicago, north into Canada, Toronto, Windsor, and yes, into Oxford, Ohio. For obvious reasons, the records are indistinct. There could not be kept minute, detailed records of what the espionage was about. For obvious reasons, most of the secrets were committed to memory, were never put into paper. If you were captured, your instructions were to take your life rather than reveal what you were carrying. In many a lonely road, a spy would meet an untimely end, and no one would ever know what had happened or why. At the end of the war, the last thing that Judah Benjamin did in Richmond in his office was leave it go into the espionage headquarters, next office to his, and burn the last remaining records. Lottie Moon must remain a woman of mystery, but these things we do know. In the spring of 1861, after her two brothers had left Oxford to fight for the South in uniforms of gray, one night, shortly before midnight, there was a clattering of horses' hooves down High Street. A solitary rider, at breakneck speed, coming down High Street, pulled up in front of the Moon house and stopped. Off the horse jumped one Walker Taylor, nephew of a former president of the United States, Zachary Taylor. A posse was hard after him. He was in espionage service in support of the Southern effort. He went into the Moon house, hoping to avoid capture. He knew the Moons. They knew him. They welcomed him. They secreted him. A few minutes later, down High Street came the posse. Dozens of armed men. They, too, pulled up at the Moon House. Pounded on the door. No response. Pounded on the door. No response. Pounded on the door. Finally, the door opened. And a sleepy voice from within, "What can we do for you? Have you seen a Lone Rider?" "No. No. Why?" "Well, there's been a man come into Oxford. We're chasing. We're trying to catch him. If you see him, let us know." "All right. All right. Thank you. Good night." Walker Taylor wouldn't complete that mission. The next morning, it was a female figure that left the Moon House. As Lottie would engage in her first espionage activity in behalf of the Confederacy to take the dispatches that Walker Taylor had on his person down to Lexington. Those would be about the only dispatches she would carry thereafter. She would go with memorization of what it was she was to deliver. Her trail would take her across the north and through a score of communities and thence into the south to deliver messages to Richmond, to Lexington, Nashville. She would go north into Canada, to Toronto, to Windsor. She was a brilliant actress. She could put on a host of disguises. She could be a young woman, an old, a middle-aged. She could range in her national origins from Irish to English to French and affect the dialect to go with each. Perhaps the most remarkable mission that she conducted was to bring information back from Toronto, Canada, which was a key southern espionage center in soil of a land outside the reaches of federal law. She would bring back messages from Toronto, Canada to Jefferson Davis down in Richmond. And in getting there, she would ride in the carriage of Abraham Lincoln with President Lincoln. She did it by posing as a titled Englishwoman of noble birth, Lady Hull, complete with English accent to go with it, fine array of costuming. She arrived in Washington, D.C., reporting to have come over to New York on an English vessel, coming then to Washington, trying to find a way to get down into central Virginia, she said, to take the warm baths and springs there that might help her cure her arthritis. And she had a bad case of arthritis. As she talked with the Secretary of War, Abraham Stanton of Steubenville, Ohio, she could hardly stand up. Secretary Stanton had compassion. "Poor Lady Hull, didn't you realize that there's a war on over here? And that where you're trying to go in central Virginia is right there near the theater of operations?" "Yes, she had heard of a war, but she hadn't realized it was that close. How could she get down there to central Virginia?" Completely taken in by her act, Secretary Stanton said, "I think I have the way. President Lincoln himself is going down to review the troops in Virginia on the morrow. I'll give you a pass to ride in the president's own carriage." And the next day, there in the fall of 1862, there was Oxford's own Lottie Moon, traveling from Washington, D.C., down into Virginia in the carriage with President Lincoln on one side and Secretary of War Abraham Stanton on the other side, engaging them in polite conversation all the way as this English noblewoman, Lady Hull. It was a number of weeks later that Abraham Stanton finally realized what had happened. When a key piece of information that should never have gotten to the Confederacy had obviously gotten to them, he came to appreciate that he'd been duped by the Confederate spy Lottie Moon. He said personally he would put $10,000 on her head, dead or alive. That was what she meant to him. Lottie Moon participated in scores of missions until in April of 1863 she participated in one too many. You can trick your way past virtually everyone, but somewhere out there there will be someone that will be a doubting Thomas. And it turned out to be a lowly private who wasn't taken in wholly with what Lottie Moon was telling him, this time in the accent of an Irish washerwoman. There was something that didn't ring true to this lowly private. He suggested that she ought to tell her story to his commanding officer. Yes, she would be glad to, she said in her Irish brogue. They started up the steps together. The private opened the door. In she walked into the office of the new commanding general of the defensive theater, including all of southern Ohio, southeastern Indiana, and northern Kentucky. There he stood in his general stars, Ambrose E. Burnside. And there she stood, trying to continue to act the part of an Irish washerwoman. And you know, somehow the words just didn't come out the way they were supposed to. Somehow the accent didn't quite remain what it should have been. And she faltered and stammered and repeated herself. Until Ambrose finally said, "All right, Lottie, you can forget it. I know who you are." She continued on in the Irish washerwoman dialect, and Burnside stopped her again. "All right, Lottie, I know who you are." And at that point, Lottie Moon knew that the jig was up. She had it. She was trapped. And at that point, the tears began to flow. And she reminded Ambrose of all the good times that it had together. As if Ambrose could forget it. She knew what would happen to her if she was turned over as the spy that she was. She knew that 10,000 pounds, dead or alive, put up by the Secretary of War himself. She knew what the fate of a captured spy would be. So did Burnside. If there was ever a man who had every reason to have said, "No way am I going to be lenient," it was Ambrose Burnside. His deepest frustration had been that day back in June 1848, when Lottie had stood him up at the altar. But for some reason, the spark was still there. He couldn't bring himself to turn her over and have her sentenced and executed. And so he determined in his own mind he would put her under house arrest on the pledge that she would not attempt to escape from the Burnett House in Cincinnati for the duration of the war. She gave her pledge. She kept it. He gave her his pledge. He would not reveal her identity. Lottie Moon would spend the rest of the war in Cincinnati, Ohio, under house arrest. General Burnside had saved her life. At last, the war ended at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. Lottie would return to Oxford. She and Jim Clark would move out of Ohio, heading east to New York City, where they'd get employment as journalists. Lottie herself would come to cover the Franco-Prussian War in Europe in 1870. She couldn't stay away from where the action was. She had to go right to it. Then later in the 70s, she turned her hand to the writing of novels. She wrote three in the late 70s, the early 80s, under the pen name of a man, Charles Clay. In 1881, her husband died. She went to live with her son, an Episcopalian rector in Philadelphia. There she died in 1895. She died as she lived, a woman of mystery. We have only the fragmentary outlines of her life, particularly of those war years, for obvious reasons. They couldn't be set down in minute detail. But we have today a house there on the corner of High and University. Empty, and yet filled with memories of a wedding day in January of 1849, of a midnight rider in 1861, family that retained its loyalty to the South, though it was now living in the North. We call it the Lottie Moon House. We have uptown a restaurant. What do you call a restaurant that bears the name of Lottie Moon? Why, underground, of course. What else can you do with the name of a spy? And there's even an attic on the underground. And over in Liberty, Indiana, a few miles down the road, we have Ambrose Burnside Park. Not very big, but it's there. A little sign that proclaims it. But you know, here in 1982, it's the jilted fiancé that we remember most of all. Not the woman who jilted him. Ambrose Burnside is coming to his own in a most peculiar way. Ambrose Burnside, officer, general, gentleman, had a peculiar way of styling his facial hair. His men took note of it. They called these attractive stylings Burnsides. The years have passed. The term would be convoluted until here in the 20th century you refer to them not as Burnsides, but as sideburns. And about every young man today that goes into the barber invokes the memory of Ambrose E. Burnside as he asks for that trim on the side just where he wants it. It's a great all-around fine student, big man on campus. You know, next spring would be his 50th anniversary. Were he living? And is he living? We don't know. Maybe somewhere out there, there is a man approaching 50 who still wonders what he did in his first 20 years of life and where those 20 years were spent. And we, on the other side of the coin, think of a young lady who probably more often than not will be thought of as an 18-year-old who would stand there in front of a large group, look a handsome young man up and down the side of her, and respond to a minister, "No, sirree, Bob, I won't." Great to be with you to talk about Ronald Tamman and Lottie Moon. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this Your Connected audio podcast. If you have suggestions for future podcasts, please let us know by contacting your Miami University Alumni Association.